Good morning and welcome to the program. Hi. It's quite a bit warmer outside today than usual, which makes you kind of feel comfortable. Maybe you want to go out and do something today. It's it feels that good. It was probably 59 degrees. It's like shorts and short-sleeve shirt weather. Anyway, this program is Health Essentials. If you've never heard it before, maybe you're driving down the highway or you're on the internet somewhere tuning in. Thank you so much for taking time. I have quite a bit of information I want to share with you this morning, and obviously there's probably going to be a silver lining and gold nuggets in almost any of the things that I might share with you. But the first one that I came across that I caught my attention, I find myself agreeing with, is a story about Elizabeth Buehler. She is the oldest Canadian that just recently died before her 112th birthday. I think this was back in, I don't know, a few years ago. Anyway, she was born in the Ukraine in 1899. That's the same year that my grandfather, Roy Allen Morgan Sr., was born. And she immigrated to Canada with her husband, where she worked a Manitoba farm. Now, the news reports credit her long life to her cheerful, positive attitude and a deep desire to help others. But she obviously consumed farm food most of her life, and she continued to the end, and including some of her guilty pleasures. And one of her guilty pleasures included something that greatly concerned her physicians. Even though, obviously, at nearly 112, you've probably outlived just about all your physicians. Little joke there. But her guilty pleasure that her physicians just hated was eating lard. Lard is always bad, said her doctors. Well, it didn't kill her. Anyway, there's such a bias against butter and coconut oil. But I think if you would come to the table with a clean spoon and just ask yourself a question, is this really as toxic as they say it is, or maybe it's a whole lot better than they would have us believe? Anyway, I want to read this to you. It comes from a study on heart disease. In the mid-1980s, they took 120 men from San Francisco, and these 120 men, they'd all had a heart attack. They had their first heart attack. And so they served as the untreated control group in the massive multiple risk factor intervention trial, which is abbreviated, or the acronym, Mr. Fit Study. So 120 men, they had a heart attack, they got in the study. This study completely disappointed many psychologists and cardiologists. By ultimately finding no effect on cardiovascular disease by training to change these men's personalities. From type A, that means they went from aggressive, time-urgent, and hostile, to type B, easygoing. You can interpret that however you want. The 120 untreated controls, however, were of great interest to Gregory Buchanan, then a graduate student at Penn State. I guess that's in Pennsylvania. And to me, because so much was known about their first heart attacks, they knew exactly the extent of the damage to the heart. And again, this is the middle 1980s, but they could determine what the damage was. They knew what all the blood pressure readings were. They could measure, well, back then, they probably didn't measure every form of cholesterol, but they could do the basic stuff back in the 80s. I mean, they could measure total cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, which is often referred to as bad. They could measure HDL cholesterol. They could measure triglycerides. Now, they've got more, I mean, as the story unfolds with laboratory tests, they do get better and more precise, and that's good. That's a good thing. They knew what their body mass was like. They knew what their lifestyle was like. They knew if they were, these are all the traditional risk factors for heart disease. In addition, the men were all interviewed about their lives. They were interviewed all about their family and their marriages and their relationships. They were interviewed about their jobs, likes, dislikes, pleasure, satisfaction. They even asked them about interests outside of work, like hobbies they were involved in. And they took every single statement from each of their videotape interviews, and they coded them for optimism and pessimism. And so another way of saying it is, when they were interviewed, they tried to determine each statement they had made from the questions they were answered. They were trying to find out who has more of a positive, optimistic outlook, and then who in turn has more of a pessimistic outlook. Within 8.5 years, and just listen to this, just consider it. Within 8.5 years, half the men had died of a second heart attack. And then we opened the sealed envelope. Okay? Could we, and the question is, could we predict who would have the second heart attack? Okay, now get this. Now just consider this, because these are all the things that we're told over and over and over again. So it's okay to question. Here's the answer. None of the usual risk factors predicted death. Not blood pressure. What do you think about that? They couldn't predict who was going to die and who wasn't going to die by looking at the blood pressure. And so, get this. These men had their first heart attack in the middle 1980s. Within 8.5 years, half the men had died of a second heart attack. Then they opened the envelope to try to evaluate it. And so what do they look at? They looked at blood pressure. It had no bearing whatsoever. They looked at cholesterol levels. Nope. It couldn't predict anything. There was no way that cholesterol predicted whether a man was going to have a heart attack and die of a second heart attack or not. Now, this is a study. They're trying to come to the table with a fresh set of eyes. They're trying to look at it just very logically. There's no emotions involved in here. It's not because they liked one person over the other. And so they couldn't even determine if they were going to die by how extensive the damage was from the first heart attack. So all the things that were told, none of them proved to be true in this study. Now, listen to this right here, because this is the conclusion. And you got to tell me if you can accept this or become aware of it or believe it, but it's the way it is. All right, here goes. Only optimism 8.5 years earlier predicted a second heart attack. If that's not earth-shattering, folks, I don't know what would be. Maybe not earth-shattering. That may not be the right terminology. But if that doesn't change your thinking, I don't know what will. So here we go again. Only the ability to be optimistic 8.5 years earlier, after they had their first heart attack, could they use that to predict a second heart attack. And so here's the end result, and I'll just make it short and sweet. Of the 16 most pessimistic or negative men, 15 died. So when they graded these men as being the most positive or being the most negative, this is the result. Of the 16 most pessimistic men, 15 died. Of the 16 most optimistic men, only 5 died. This finding has been repeatedly confirmed in larger studies of cardiovascular disease. Study number 2. This one kind of caught my attention also. In 1986, 1,306 veterans took the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, called the MMPI. And they were tracked for 10 years. Yeah, I can kind of get lost in all these study titles, but you got to have a title. And so that was it, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory Study. During that time, there was 162 cases of cardiac disease which occurred. The Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, they had an optimism-pessimism scale that reliably predicts the mortality in other studies. They looked at smoking cigarettes, alcohol use, blood pressure, cholesterol, body mass, family history of cardiovascular disease, and education were all measured, as well as anxiety, depression, hostility. And all of these were controlled for statistical analysis. Men that had the most optimistic style, which was just, they just were looking for one standard deviation above average, they came back with 25% less cardiovascular disease than average. And men with the least optimism, they had a 25% more cardiovascular problems. This trend was strong and continuous, indicating the greater the optimism protected men, whereas less optimism weakened them. So you tell me, does complaining do any good? Nope. Does negativity do any good? No. The reason I'm covering this is, and part of it's just, you know, I'm being honest with you, is me. I'm looking at myself in the mirror and I'm saying, Roy, have you been negative? Are you more positive? You know, in the Bible it says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Is that true? You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Okay. Next study. This comes from Holland, so it's referring to Dutch men and women. Beginning in the year 1991, they took 999 65 to 85-year-olds. Probably they just went to the local churches and say, everybody 65 and above over here, we want to talk to you. And what they did was they followed them for 9 years in the Netherlands, and in that time, 397 of them died, which is not outside of the realm of normal, because they took nearly 1,000 people aged 65 to 85, and they followed them for 9 years. So don't you think that maybe some of the 85-year-olds, if they live for like, 7 or 8 years, they might be at the end of themselves? You know, this earthen vessel is not designed to live forever. So in that 9-year time span where they followed these people, 65 to 85, 397 of them died. Now, at the outset, researchers measured health, education, how much smoking you do. Now, it's my personal opinion, but all that vaping stuff, I don't even see how that could even be remotely good. It's still poison. It is still poison. So that's just the way it is. But then again, we all have a free will to choose what we're going to do. Believe me, I ate a chocolate bar yesterday, probably the first time that I have in like, 2 months. But it called my name. It was like 87% cocoa. There wasn't a lot of sugar. And it was infused with hot, spicy cayenne peppers. I don't know why that appealed to me, but it happened. And I don't really feel guilty. Okay, so they measure them for health, education, smoking, alcohol, history of cardiovascular disease, marriage, what the marriage was like, their body mass, blood pressure, and cholesterol, along with optimism. And what they did was they measured by 4 items answered on a scale of 1 to 3 of how well the people agreed. And these were the questions. Number 1, I still expect much from life. Okay, what do you think that means? You know what that means. Number 2, I do not look forward to what lies ahead of me in the years to come. Well, first question was kind of positive. I still expect much from life. Second question, I do not look forward to what lies ahead of me in the years to come. That doesn't sound too good. Number 3, sounds kind of negative, doesn't it? Number 3, I am still full of plans. Oh, boy, does that sound positive? It does to me. Number 4, I often feel that life is full of promises. Now, when I hear the word promise, I like it. All right, here's the results. Being pessimistic or being negative was very strongly associated with mortality. That means death, particularly when holding all the other risk factors constant. Optimists had only a 23% rate of cardiovascular death. Compared to the pessimist, and only 55% the overall death rate compared to people that were pessimists. Anyway, interesting. All right. This is what I looked up this morning, and this is my research I did between 6:20 this morning and 6:35, just trying to seek and learn and get answers to questions. All right. And this comes from research right here. So the question is, why are optimists less vulnerable to disease? And of course, you can't cover every factor, but these are a few points that might bear discussing or repeating. Okay, they're asking the question, why optimists are less vulnerable to disease in a study? And they're going, or the round table discussion is, How might optimism or being positive work to make people less vulnerable? And how does being pessimistic or negative make people more vulnerable to cardiovascular disease? So they kind of broke it down to three categories. Number one, talking about optimists. And I realize as soon as I read these things to you, you're going to say, well, that's easy, I know that. But, you know, if I look at myself in the mirror, I'd say, yes, I understand and I believe that the Old Testament in the Bible was translated from the Hebrew into English. I accept that. The New Testament has been translated from the Greek to the English. I understand that too, and I believe that. What is it, the Koine Greek? It's essentially a dead language, but that's what the New Testament's been preserved in. I heard a preacher say something Sunday that there's over 14,000 documents, all independently written and recorded, but they all agree. They're all in agreement when it comes to the New Testament. I just think that's phenomenal. Point number one. Optimists take action and they have healthier lifestyles. Optimists believe that their actions matter, whereas pessimists believe they are helpless and nothing they do will matter. If you don't think that's the truth, well, tell me what is the truth then. Second point, optimists try while pessimists lapse into passive helplessness. Point number two, social support. They say in their observations that the more friends and the more love in your life, the less illness. A man by the name of George Valiant, which I like the name Valiant, doesn't that sound great? He found that people who have one person whom they would be comfortable calling at 3 a.m. to tell their troubles were healthier. Folks, doesn't the Bible tell us to confess our sins one to another and to share our troubles? It does. What's wrong with that? How else can you be encouraged unless you tell somebody what you're dealing with? John Casipio, I'm sure I butchered his name, he found that lonely people were markedly less healthier than sociable people. That just makes sense. I know you know that already. Now, this was a unique experiment they did. I'm not asking you to try this today, but if you want to, you can. In an experiment, they had participants read a script over the phone to strangers. And what they did was, there were only two choices they gave them. They said either read the script in a very depressed voice, or read the script with a cheerful voice. That's it. The strangers hang up on the pessimist sooner than the optimist. Oh, really? So that's a great study right there. You probably knew the outcome. So strangers that you don't know, when you're reading a script, they hang up on the pessimist a whole lot quicker than the optimist. So you tell me, how far is negativity going to go? Not real far. Happy people have richer social networks than unhappy people. And social connectedness contributes to a lack of disability as we age. Of course, you've never heard the phrase that misery loves company, but company does not love misery. By the way, if you complain, nobody wants to hear it. That's just the truth. When you're in misery, nobody really wants to participate with that, unless you're another miserable person. That's why misery loves company. Haven't you ever heard the phrase, birds of a feather flock together? Number three, there are some very precise biological mechanisms. I'm only going to cover just two of them in great simplicity, then we'll go to the phone lines. Of course, they're saying there are a variety of plausible biological pathways. One is the immune system. The very system that's designed to protect you from invading microbes and viruses and bacteria and parasites and worms and more things than I can even shake a stick at this morning. But it's also supposed to help clean up damaged tissue. And if there's a toxic aberrant cell that's designed to turn cancerous, well, you want your immune system to really work well, where it can just corner it and beat it up and you know, abuse it to the point of death. I really have no problem if you have T killer cells floating around in your bloodstream looking to eat cancer cells. That didn't disturb me at all. I kind of like that. Okay, in 1991, they took blood from elderly optimists and also people that were pessimistic, and they tested the immune response. Here's the result. The blood of the optimist had a feistier response to threat, meaning more infection-fighting white blood cells called T lymphocytes are produced than the pessimist. We ruled out depression, as health is confounded by that. Now, what I'm curious about is, and I hope that you don't take this in a bad way, it's just my thought, I'm starting to wonder, over the years, let me back up and give you a starting point. If you go to your doctor for lab tests, and let's just say the doctor orders or the nurse or the physician's assistant, whomever, that's fine. But if they order a lab test, well, I like those things. I think it gives you some feedback, and that's what it is. It's feedback. It's just supposed to be positive all the way around. Yeah, what if you see some numbers that aren't so good? Shouldn't that motivate you to make some changes? So hey, kids, this is life. Life is not fair. You're going to have ups, and you're going to have downs. And yes, I've heard things from doctors before. I didn't like what they said, but it was the truth. But what it did was it gave me an opportunity to go, you know what? Are you doing the right thing, or should you do it a little bit differently? And so let's look at it this way. What if a doctor or nurse orders a very simple test called a CBC with a differential? If you want to call that cell blood count or complete blood count, I'm good with that. But one of the markers usually has the abbreviation WBC. That stands for white blood cell count. And they're going to give you a range. And they may say everything from 4 to 11 is somewhere in there is a normal range. But you know the idea of what would be closer to ideal. What am I looking at that's really a good number that tells me that I've got spot-on performance, everything's working the way it wants, or that you want it to, everything's going good, to give you some confidence so you can go, you know what, I'm doing pretty well. It's maybe something I'm doing right. But what if the white blood cell count is below 5.7? So 5.7 and below, that's part and parcel to chronic low-grade infections. But is that everything? No. The blood of optimists, they had a feistier response to threats, and they had more infection-fighting white blood cells called T lymphocytes produced than people that were real negative or pessimistic. And so maybe we could come to the table and come up with a different idea. Maybe, don't know this, but I'm asking a question because I want to figure it out. Maybe people that chronically have white low blood cell counts or less than adequate white blood cells, maybe there's an underlying issue or a problem with negativity. I don't know. I'm just asking. Sheldon Cohen, as you will recall, I'm just reading this from an article, they found that sad people secrete more of the inflammatory substance that's called interleukin-6, and this results in more colds. We're not talking about babies here, but we'll move on to adults. You know anybody that is sick all the time? So Dr. Cohen found that sad people secrete more of the inflammatory substance called interleukin-6, and this results in more colds. Repeated episodes of stress and helplessness set off a cascade of processes involving higher levels of cortisol. That's a hormone that's produced by your adrenal glands, and it's designed to save you. But too much of it, because you've been under too much stress, been too negative for too long, it will rip you to shreds. I think I know that as well as anybody. And you also have, when you have a lot of stress and you feel helpless and you're negative, you have lower levels of neurotransmitters, like serotonin. And what is the number one medical treatment for all depression and anxiety? Well, they give drugs to bolster serotonin, but maybe there's a mechanism that we need to address here. Maybe, really, we have a poor self-image and we don't communicate so well with ourselves. Those that have the highest level of depression, they've been shown to have the worst calcification of the arteries. When they've done experiments on rats, helpless rats in the triadic design, I'm not sure what that is, they develop atherosclerosis, that's hardening of the arteries, at a faster rate than that demonstrate happiness and mastery. That's just another idea. Point number next. Let's talk about the liver. Your liver does an incredible job at trying to keep your blood from being too thick, making sure it's not too thin. So there's a substance that your liver produces called heparin. There's another substance called albumin. But there's another substance that your liver produces, and it might be good for you to write this down. It's called fibrinogen. It's a substance that your liver produces that's used in the clotting of blood. So here's the research. Excessive production by the liver of a substance called fibrinogen, which is used in clotting the blood, is just one more plausible mechanism why either optimists are less vulnerable to disease, or why pessimists or negative people are more vulnerable. All right. The more fibrinogen leads to more blood clots in the circulatory system by making the blood sludgy and thick and dirty. You really want your heart pumping around blood that's as thick as jello or caulking or thick paint? No. That's stress. That makes it hard. And so people that have a high positive emotion, they show less fibrinogen response to stress than those with a low positive emotion. Anyway, that's from the book called Flourish by Martin P. Siegelman. I just find research so interesting and into insight. And I think it's just fine if we set our minds to learn and to study these great creations that God's made for us. Good morning and welcome to the program. How are you today?
Hello.
Did I catch you off guard by answering the phone?
Yeah.
Okay. You're on. Go ahead.
Okay, sir. I try to listen to you every Saturday morning. I'm a truck driver. I drive at night. I've met you a couple times.
Yeah, oh yeah. I know who you are exactly. FedEx
okay.
driver.
Yes, sir. And you are a godsend, buddy.
Well, you're just too kind. Thanks.
I believe it was last Saturday, may have been one before, talking about oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard you say before that everybody ought to have one of those barometric oxygen, whatever it is.
Well, in my fantasy world, we would all be able to visit each weekend to the Garden of Eden where they had about 36% oxygen. Yeah, that would be my fantasy.
Right. Well, I just turned 60, and I've been getting all these old folk magazines. You know how you get in the mail?
No, I don't, and I don't want them.
Okay. No, sir. Anyway, they were advertising some Boost oxygen in a can, and heck, I tried it. And I'm just, a can will last 201-second whiffs of it.
Well, you tell me, what are the results? What did you discover?
Well, mister, in less than 2 weeks. Now, the reason I even wanted it was to try to keep myself awake and alert. There's a time in the morning time when I'm coming in when I get really, really sleepy.
Oh, man, how could you not be that way with the hours you're working?
Yes, and I do not and never have liked having to take like those 5-hour shots. They work because I've had to take them.
Mm-hmm. But, man, well, that technically is better than falling asleep and driving to an oak tree that's been on the side of the road for 200 years.
Yes, sir.
Because I observed during that ice storm what happens to a full-size pickup when it hits an oak tree.
Ooh, the
tree wins, the truck loses.
Wasn't your truck, was it?
No, but you know what? I got out of the truck because the airbag was deployed, and I just knew I was going to find a dead person in the truck.
Oh, God.
I did not. So I'm... But you know what? You know how your mind can do that, though, when you see a vehicle crash on the side of the road and you get out to see if everybody's okay? Anyway. Yeah, go ahead. But would you say that it was a very positive outcome with the oxygen?
I have. Well, it does absolutely wake me up instantly.
Oh, about, how about that?
About three whiffs of it, and I've had an 8-hour nap.
Mm-hmm.
But as a side deal, I've noticed, man, I feel stronger, and of course, they advertise that it'll give you a feeling of well-being, whatever the heck that is. But maybe that's it, because I feel stronger, and I've actually experienced some difference in some urinary problems I've had. They're going away.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, now, how do you interpret all this, and what do you think you want to do? Tell me what you want to accomplish.
I bought me a whole case of this stuff. Got to tell me.
Okay. Well, that's one thing, but you realize, never in the history of mankind on Earth have they relied on oxygen tanks.
Right.
So what do you think that says about your oxygen saturation and the efficiency of your lungs and your heart and your blood and your muscles?
Well, it's that it was low. Now,
what's your plan to turn that around?
Exercise and deep breathing and...
Mm-hmm.
Now, according to the doctors, every time I get a physical, my oxygen's been great, so I don't know what to say about that. But I do know, and I wanted to put it out there, that the oxygen thing is A number one, and you're a godsend for that.
Right. Thank you very, very much.
And I mean, it's helping my entire body.
You know what I think is hard for people to do?
What's that?
I think it's really hard for people to ever relax.
Yeah, you're probably right.
I'm talking about myself also.
you're probably
right. It's hard
right.
to ever be in a state, and you know, little kids, they breathe so freely that tummy just hangs out, pushes in and out, and they're just playing and laughing all the time. They're relaxed.
Well, people don't take deep breaths when they breathe. Everybody's a shallow breather. I was myself.
Oh. I know what it's like to hold your breath when you're under great stress. It never works. But it's easy to do when you're under stress.
Right. You know, talking about the sleeping, I noticed another thing, and I've noticed this twice, and it's really weird. Now, my hours, I sleep during the day, I go to work at 7 o'clock at night. Well, twice since I've been on this oxygen thing, and I don't take a lot of it. It's just two or three whiffs every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
I've awoken and felt like it was morning time. I know what time it is, but I felt like I've just got a good night's sleep in this morning.
Mm-hmm.
That, I know that sounds weird, but
no, it doesn't sound weird at all.
And it takes a while for me to even shake it off. That it's, you know, because it's dark when I go to work, but I'm waiting on daylight because in my mind, when I'm not thinking, you know, it's fixing me daylight because I just got up and I had a good night's sleep.
Well, what I think you need to do is just take a look in the mirror and decide exactly what you want to accomplish and what would serve you best. And I know that I'm an oversimplifier, but it's in your best interest to resolve any problems that you have with your health to where you have the health that you're very, very pleased with so it can serve you well.
Right.
Obviously, the whole purpose of me reading the articles that I read earlier this morning is just kind of coming to the table and deciding what is it that you actually want to accomplish. And I think until we actually put some serious thought to that, it's going to be very, very hard to do because, I mean, you can in general, I'm just saying, you know, Lord, help me be a better man. I mean, that's not a bad prayer, but that's very, very general. Well, what do you mean, be a better man? Well, you might say, well, I've got a problem with, laziness, or maybe I'm negative, or maybe I have some very bad habits, or I have some bad thought patterns, or maybe I'm eating very poorly, and I'm, choosing, to put things in my body that are not promoting what a really productive, happy man would, consume. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And well, when you're more specific, I think that's really a good thing. Then you can specifically, I heard a minister one time, not that long ago, I think his name was Jeff, but he said specifically that he prays to God specifically that he will not have a stroke or heart attack like his parents had. And I just kind of, it really kind of caught me off guard. But anyway, it's just food for thought.
Yes.
But you can, all these things you want. So to me, it's very, if I just look at the one point that you made, if I tell you that I think that maybe oxygen might be the greatest element produced in God's creation to benefit man, then I would say, oh my word. Yeah, it's phenomenal. Now, I'm not trying to make it a panacea where it covers everything. I just know this, with no oxygen, you don't have life, do you?
No, sir.
But when you...
The one thing, like I said on this stuff, it's given me the energy to start doing some other things that I didn't have. And this is fast, buddy. This is like a less than a week and a half. You know, I get home and I've got the energy to work on some stuff, you know, work on building a fence that I started or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that's
good. And, of course, I've gotten off of bread because I'm not quite paleo, but I know bread and sugar is killing people.
I think it is, yeah.
The sugar especially.
See, sugar is not supposed to be bad, and bread is not supposed to be bad, but we have done everything we can to alter it from its original form to a completely different animal.
Yes, sir.
And so you interpret that exactly, you know, how you want to, but there has to come a moment where you're thinking, all right, all these carbohydrates, all this excessive, and what I should say is all these excessive carbohydrates. When we eat more than what our body can handle, yeah, you're asking your blood to become about as acidic as possible. You're asking to wreck your oxygen levels. But all these things can only be changed over time by doing things differently. And so if you want your body to transform, you got to kind of transform your mind as to what to do.
That's right. Well, I've been eating chicken and pea salad all week.
Chicken and pea salad, all right. Well, does that mean you're not eating Twinkies and donuts and drinking Cokes? Okay, then.
No.
All right, that's good.
I'm eating chicken and pea. Well, my wife makes really good pea salad. And
I mean, doesn't it say in Romans 12:21, do not be overcome by evil, but rather overcome evil with good? And so the bottom line is you got to replace, you know, the bad with the good, right?
Right.
And so if you're eating chicken, you're not eating... corn dogs.
I don't know. Like I said, this oxygen thing is turning my head around. It's
totally... I know, but what it's done though is precisely uncovered a weakness that you have, and I think you need to just come to terms with that and say, okay, what do I really need to do to turn this around, where my body can take care of itself? Because you know, it's just not plausible to walk around with an oxygen tank and drive a truck all day long.
Well, no, that's what I say, but I've only had to take 2 or 3 whiffs, you know, maybe when I get sleepy is the only time I use it. But it's caused things, I think, to start working better.
Yeah, and so let that be a jump start for you. That's great.
Well, see, that's what I'm looking at. It's actually just, we breathe it but 21%.
This is the easiest thing for me to say. Oxygen is used to convert your food into energy. And so let's just say it this way. When your body delivers oxygen and food, whether that's protein or carbohydrate or fat, it has to cross the cell membrane to get in the cell. And let's just say an average muscle cell that you have has 2,000 mitochondria. That's where all this stuff ends up. So that's like the engine where all this is burned. So the simple point is, when you put a lot of carbohydrates in your body, I mean, you can tell if you measure triglyceride levels and they're above 80, hey, you're eating a whole lot more carbohydrates than what you should. Simple as that. The only stored form of fat in the human body is a triglyceride. And what does tri mean? It means three. What's glyceride? It's 3 sugar molecules. What does that tell you?
Okay.
And so when you take sugar and you throw it into the cells and say, here, I want you to burn this, and you have to react oxygen with it, it burns so dirty, it creates so much reactive oxygen species called free radicals or you know, oxidative damage, that it's just a pathway to destruction. But when you burn fat for fuel, every time in every experiment, like with a ketogenic diet, The same thing has proven over and over and over again. You have more available oxygen. And that's a mechanism that's doable, because if you set your mind like Flint that that's what you want, you'll start to see a tremendous change in your weight. You'll see a change in your body composition. You'll start to feel physically better. And I think this is great that you've done this experiment, but the bottom line is work on the things you can work on.
Right. Well, I've done, you know, the Atkins on and off. And
I never said Atkins. I said ketogenic.
Well, I know.
Yeah.
I'm just telling you that I have, you know, and that's what I tell my wife. I got to get off this bread because you feel great. You feel, after 3 days, you feel 100% better after you get the carbs out of your system. It takes about 3 days.
Then, you're right.
And I mean, then you feel like $1 million. But it's so hard to stay off of carbs, you know, in the way we live nowadays.
You're right. But you know what I want you to become? I want you to become stronger. I want you to become stronger to where you can resist the carbs and replace them with something good. And
well,
I think but you just said it just takes 3 days. I had a woman tell me a story the other day. She said, I was so sick of being in so much pain and being so exhausted and so depressed that I just jumped in with both feet. I said, what'd you do? She said, all I did was start shoveling coconut oil in my mouth. It was painful. It was brutal. But 3 days later, I was a brand new person. I no longer desired the carbohydrates. So I know it can be done very, very quickly.
What's the deal with coconut oil? Because coconut oil, I mean, you can take a spoonful, it tastes good.
What do you mean, what's the deal with it? You just answered your own question. I agree.
But what does it do for you?
Well, I just mentioned a while ago that when you put fat into your body, it burns very cleanly along with oxygen. It doesn't give off a lot of waste or debris.
Okay,
it increases oxygen, yeah. So that's another way of saying it. And these
what about this beet powder they're talking about?
That's a whole different topic, but it's going to be a high source of nitrates, which increases your body's production of nitric oxide.
Right.
But nothing is superior to sunbathing and being happy. You're going to have the highest levels of nitric oxide when you're happy because you're more relaxed.
Well, I'm happy.
Good.
Me and my wife, we're always together and always laughing and picking at each other. I mean, we just have a ball.
Good. Well, listen, keep up the good work, and I wish you the very best, and, man, I'm rooting for you.
All right, sir. Thank you.
All right. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
All right.
All right, if you'd like to join the radio program, there's a phone line officially open at 903-586-5257. Good morning. Welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm doing great. Hello, Dr. Morgan.
Hello.
I have a craze report.
Let's hear it.
Well, you put me on a ketogenic diet last year in March, and
I didn't do that. You did that all by yourself.
That's true. You suggested that I do that. And
I don't even remember
that. April 3rd, I went on this ketogenic diet, and I've pretty much been on it till now. I'm still on it. I went off of it a little bit for Christmas, but just for like a day. And 2.5 years ago, I had lung surgery. And my surgeon wanted to operate on my other lung. And so I had to wait to get insurance. So I have insurance.
Oh, yeah. How could anybody afford that otherwise?
Right. And so anyway, I went to see him the other day after my MRI and all this other stuff. And he told me that I no longer needed lung surgery because my lung had healed itself.
Isn't that amazing? That is phenomenal. See, there, the body can heal itself given the right circumstances.
I mean, I thought I'd give you, like, this really cool praise report, you know.
Oh,
because,
great.
You know, you're always talking about, you know, if you eat and blah, 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 and if you do this.
Well,
do
I
that,
mean,
and
how are you going to survive without food? There's
no
way around it.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, if you eat, like, a certain way, and I found that eating a ketogenic diet is the thing for me. Although I do miss certain things, like when went off of ketogenic diet, I love rice, and so
what's wrong with you having that occasionally? Because nobody can be perfect 100% of the time. You can just cycle in and out of it, and so if you have a day that you indulge in rice, I don't see a problem with that at all.
All right, that's good because I've been really trying to stick to it.
Well,
like
no, and I know you're doing it to help yourself, but I can just tell you the human body needs variety. You can't always be up. You can't always be down. You just can't stay in one state all the time. You got to have variety of emotions. You got to have a variety of mental states, and you certainly have got to have a variety of foods. I mean, what would life be like if you had to eat asparagus as your only food source three times a day?
That would be disgusting.
Well, but do you like asparagus?
I do, but I wouldn't want it three times a day.
Well, and, you know, but it's nice one. It's really nice once a week, or Brussels sprouts are great twice a week.
Right.
And there may be other foods that you can have every single day. Like, for me, I could eat eggs every day, and I'm really pleased and happy.
Yes, I probably eat eggs. Just about every day. It's just one of the things.
But I mean, not everybody likes eggs, though. Just like, you know how many people I've said, what do you think about eating avocado? And they go, yuck, I can't take the texture. Well, it doesn't matter. They have to find something that they can. But I can tell you, the healthiest people on earth, they have variety. They eat a lot of different things. Just like, have you ever gone to one of those exotic salad bars where you're going, I have never seen this many olives before. I have never seen, you know, all these different choices. And sometimes it's just fun just to try a little bit of everything, if you ask me. What would life be like if all you did was eat eggs, two eggs for breakfast, and you had a piece of bologna for lunch and Spam for supper, and that was it?
That would be living hell as far as I'm concerned.
May not have a lot to look forward to for supper if it was Spam. I didn't say Spam is the worst thing of all time. Could be close.
Could be close, so I have to agree with that.
But you got to have variety, so it doesn't disturb me one iota that you're saying you miss rice. I think you should have some.
Well, then I will. I will have it occasionally because I like Thai food, so, you know, it's kind of hard to eat Thai food without rice. Anyway, but I just thought I would let you know what this cool phrase report. I was just like,
oh, that's great. You totally made my day. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Man. Well, I'm really rooting for you.
I told the doc what I was doing, and he looked at me and he said, well, that means that you're not causing any inflammation in your lungs.
Oh.
I said, right. And he said,
Is this a lung specialist?
Yes.
How long has he been a lung surgeon?
Quite a while, I think, because he put me on when I had my surgery, as soon as they took me off of steroids and all this other stuff, he walked in and he put me on a high-protein, high-fat diet with no sugar and no bread and no grains. And he said, I want you to eat this so your reconnective tissue will...
Mm-hmm. You think that was pretty good advice?
I think it was, actually.
Yeah.
I was the only person in the heart hospital with salt sitting on my thing and had avocados and all this yummy food just all in my room, and I was eating constantly, and people were like,
that is very, very funny. That's good. I like that. Well, this is good. Maybe somebody else will hear your story, and they'll go, you know what? Maybe my lung problems are not the end of the world. Maybe I can do something different. And that would be a good thing.
Yeah, so anyway, I just thought I'd give you that cool praise report.
Oh, I'm glad you did. Thank you so much, ma'am. I hope you have a great day.
Hey, God bless you.
God bless you. Thanks a bunch. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, there's a phone line officially open at 903-586-5257. Thank you very much for calling. How can I help?
Hi. I was wanting to ask you about hypothyroidism.
Yes, ma'am.
Let me get you off speaker just a second.
Thank you very much.
I'll get back to that just a second. I'm sorry.
No, you're doing great.
Just a minute. Well, I was wondering, I've been taking levothyroxine, but I'm trying to... I've actually gotten off of it, but I'm wondering what you would recommend to be the best thing to take, to substitute that. I've been taking medicine probably for about 15 years or more.
Well, that does make it a bit more challenging. Let me just explain the reason why, and this is not meant to, you know, discourage you from what you want to accomplish, but as human beings, we're designed to adapt to situations. So when you take levothyroxine for 15 years, your pituitary is really, really dependent and used to that feedback right now, and that makes it a little bit more challenging. So I would say in simplicity, there's a gland in the brain called the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus is constantly, whether you want to say licking or drinking or tasting or sensing your blood levels of thyroid hormones, it is. And if it thinks they're Goldilocks just right, it tells the pituitary to tell the thyroid, just keep doing what you're doing. But if it's not right, like if you have an underactive thyroid, as in hypothyroidism, it sends a hormone to the pituitary saying, could you tell the thyroid to make a little bit more hormone, you know, because we don't have enough. But this is a very, very complex story, because what I really wanted to say the moment you called is we're going to find that there's factors at play, whether you know it or not, that are influencing your thyroid in a very, very negative way. And let me just flesh a couple of those out. There are two glands that sit up on, well, one gland is on top of the right kidney and one gland is on top of the left kidney. They're called the adrenal glands. And the adrenal glands are what your body uses to make sure you can respond to each and everything that happens to you, whether it's good or whether it's bad. So the adrenal glands, they have a huge regulatory control over the thyroid. And so if you're producing too many stress hormones for too long, that is just going to beat down the thyroid where it becomes more and more worn out, exhausted, and sluggish. Number two, there is a hormone that makes you completely, uniquely all girl. And that hormone's called estrogen. And if there's too much of it, it will completely shut down your thyroid. There's another hormone that your body produces called progesterone. Sure, I guess I have a little bit. Probably not anything like you do, because you're a very, very feminine woman. You're a feminine girl. And so progesterone plays a very powerful role. It makes sure you can transport thyroid molecules. So if your thyroid produces T3, T4, for example, to be able to get those into the cell where they can regulate your energy production or how much oxygen you have, that's really what I should have told the last caller, the gentleman that called. Your thyroid has a lot to do with your oxygen levels, so I would probably look at the thyroid as maybe not working as well as it should. But you've got to have adequate production of progesterone. And so the typical woman's supposed to be about 10 parts progesterone to one part estrogen. And so if you're trying to solve this and figure it out, you got to say, okay, where is my main problem? Is it because I have a female hormone imbalance? That's a possibility. Is it because my adrenals are overproducing stress hormones? Now, I can tell you, that is one of the most likely possibilities that I encounter over and over again. And I know I sound like a broken record, but if I see that once, I probably see it three times a week easily as the main culprit. And you never get the thyroid back online unless you correct the adrenal problem. Number next. If the pituitary is sluggish, it's very common for the hips to be achy and weak. And so if you were to sit on the floor and cross your legs Indian style and you get up and you go, hey, my feet feel fine, my ankles feel fine, my knees feel great, my legs feel great, but my hips, oh boy, are they hurting me. If both of them are prone to being sore and achy, that makes me think of a weak pituitary. And so your pituitary is like the master controller of the symphony. It tells everybody in the orchestra what their part is and what they're supposed to do. Now, how the maestro does that, I do not know, because I'm really not musically inclined that way. I love music, but I couldn't read it or tell how to direct it. And so somewhere in here, we got to be able to solve this mystery and figure it out. Now, the last thing that I want to kind of present to you is the thyroid is the most easily damaged gland in the female body, if you ask me. And let me just illustrate one factual bit of evidence or research. But years ago, probably 15, there was a study in an endocrinology. It was an endocrinology study based on women that have thyroid problems. And so endocrinology is the study of hormones. So if you were to have a hormone problem, you might go to a endocrinologist. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. They were just looking, what is the highest correlation toward women having a hypothyroid? And this is what they came up with. They said there's an 87% correlation. This was higher than any other correlation they found. So when women, whether they know it or not, they're using plastic spatulas that have anti-flame retardant chemicals in them. Those are basically molecules of fluoride or fluorine. That's an element in nature that I think is toxic. But anyway, so when you have the situation like this and you're using nonstick cookware or you're throwing popcorn in the microwave, that's still fluoride right there. That's what keeps it from catching on fire. So the more fluoride you have in your life, the more the thyroid just gets poisoned and poisoned and poisoned. And I realize probably nobody's ever told you this information before. But, I mean, you don't by chance use a skillet where the egg just slides around without grease, right?
No, I do use glass pans, glass skillets, glass pans.
Yeah, and that's not the problem. That's perfect. You're doing great there.
Yeah, so it would be. I try to drink a lot of water, but I've just heard that the
It contains fluoride, and fluoride is a known toxic substance to the thyroid. And so I just kind of broke it down. There's always a hormonal component. There's stress hormone component. There's a pituitary component, hypothalamus. And there's a toxicity. I haven't even talked about how to nourish a thyroid yet, but there's lots of ways to do that. I mean, for example, I could probably state a case this morning that kelp is a superfood, and that's been well studied for a long period of time. And so sometimes what the thyroid really needs, it just needs to be nourished. And so with the very little time that we have left, I think the thyroid loves cod liver oil. That's my opinion. I know I'm not giving you like a real scientific base on that. And I think the thyroid loves natural B vitamins, not synthetic ones. I think you're giving it a chance to work its very best when you create a condition for it. The thyroid needs minerals. Obviously, it needs magnesium and zinc and manganese and selenium and iodine. Any of those, if you're lacking, can be a problem. So what you can do is you can go to the store and you can buy one of those antiseptics called a 2% iodine solution, and it has a little bee bottle. I mean, like if you had a bad cut, you didn't want it to get infected, you'd put the iodine on there, right?
Yes.
And so you can just take it and just paint your forearm like a 2-inch by 2-inch square, and it'll come out this brownish, yellowish, orangish color with the iodine on there, and just note the time. So if you say, okay, it's exactly 8 o'clock on Saturday morning, I just put the iodine on there, this is only a screening test. But if that colored iodine is still bold like the second you put it on there 24 hours later, then your iodine levels are probably really, really good. But on the other hand, on the flip side of the coin, if that iodine patch has completely disappeared at 6 hours, that means your thyroid is so incredibly thirsty for iodine that it's sucking every drop of that through the skin as quickly as possible. Now, in the real world, if you have a severe iodine deficiency, yes, you could try taking more levothyroxine, but that doesn't correct an iodine deficiency. At least I haven't heard of it in, nearly 30 years. And there's a lot of other factors also, but those are the things that I would lay out to you as a way to go about trying to solve this mystery, and it's all solvable.
Okay, let me ask you real quick. I did talk to someone, to get some different advice what to do, because I'm trying to find another doctor, but raw thyroid, kelp, and latriocine.
Tyrosine. Yeah.
Latriocine.
Yeah, there you go. That would be feeding your thyroid. Good call.
Do you think that...
all you can do is try it. That's all you can do. You can put everything to the test, and if that starts to turn it around, then all right, all I did was nourish and feed my thyroid the very thing it needs, and I'm better. And so you can conclude from that evidently it was hungry for food and you fed it. So that would be an easy experiment. But if it doesn't work, you have to be open that it maybe didn't address the root cause of the problem.
Right. Should I, after a few days, be feeling kind of funny? I mean, being off of the thyroid, would that
be? Well, I can't answer that right now because I'm officially out of time. But if you'll call next week, we'll pick it up where we left off, okay?
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to KBGS, FM 90.3, Jacksonville, Tyler Long.